The idea that our erotic lives and what we feel are actually the source of our power. And there's all these systems that are keeping us from being able to feel that power. So pleasure activism is my dance with those ideas, is saying like, we actually deserve to feel good and to feel happy, and we deserve to know what it is to feel satisfied.
The thing that occurs to me is so much about this that we're talking about is feeling. And the best part about feeling is that there's no language to hold it.
We're wild animals. We're nature beings. Like, there is a part of us that has to be wild, and our rage is good medicine.
And that's this idea of feral joy, is that like, the more I interacted with rage, the more my capacity for joy grew.
I'm willing to shine a light on the clitoris, or shine a light on pleasure, or shine a light on an orgasm, or whatever it is, if that means more people will have access to that feeling in this lifetime.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Hi, I'm Matthias, and this is V1&0, the show where celebrities get cerebral. On today's episode, Maggie Rogers learns about pleasure activism. Activism is, of course, the policy or action of using vigorous campaigning to bring about political or social change. While you are undoubtedly used to seeing climate change activists, human rights activists, animal rights activists, and so on, the idea of pleasure activism is not only less ubiquitous, but probably a bit harder to wrap your head around. The thinking behind pleasure activism is that we don't need to see changing the world as another form of work or something that's arduous. Instead, justice and social liberation and the pursuit of both can in fact be pleasurable experiences. In fact, seeking out pleasure is in itself a form of rebelling against oppression. But how does pleasure activism relate to established works like Audre Lorde's book, The Erotic as Power? What are some accessible and realistic examples of pleasure activism that can make it feel less abstract? And how exactly is seeking out pleasure through sex, food, drugs, whatever, a way of revolting against certain social constructs? That's what Maggie would like to know. Maggie Rogers is a 28-year-old singer, songwriter, performer, and scholar. Famously, she first came to prominence when a clip of Pharrell Williams listening to and freaking out about her song Alaska went viral. As quickly as that video exploded, so too did Maggie's career, which saw her release her debut album, Heard It in a Past Life, and then earn a Grammy nomination for Best New Artist. Obviously, the hype that catapulted Maggie into the spotlight was not a fluke. During the pandemic, Rogers spent time writing her new album, as well as earning her master's from the Harvard Divinity School earlier this year. In July, she released her highly anticipated sophomore album, Surrender, which received favorable reviews from fans and critics alike. Currently, she's touring the globe in support of her new music. Our specialist on today's show is Adrienne Marie Brown, who grows healing ideas in public through her multi-genre writing, her music, and her podcasts. Brown is the author of Emergent Strategy, Shaping Change, Changing Worlds, as well as Pleasure Activism, The Politics of Feeling Good, and several other published texts. She is also the founder of the Emergent Strategy Ideation Institute, where she is now the writer in residence. Enjoy the show. To start things off, obviously, Surrender is out. It's been out for a while now, so congratulations on that. In listening to it, in watching interviews that you've given about it, and in looking at the lyrics, there's definitely sort of a recurring theme of sensuality and touch. And I wonder if you feel that that's because it's an album that was written during the pandemic, or if you think those are topics that you probably would have wanted to get to anyway.
I always struggle with questions about lyrics because there's a presupposition that comes in the question that sort of puts a framework around the work that I never thought about or intended it to be about, you know?
Yeah.
When I make a record, I'm always thinking about it as a record of a period of time in my life. And this record is really about everything after when I finished writing Heard It in a Past Life. So it was actually a lot about touring that record and our pandemic focus. Like, I think about Shatter and how badly I just wanted to feel something and this sort of pervading sense of numbness. But I think if anything, the record is a lot about fighting against that sense of numbness and trying to reject this idea that this was just going to be what my experience of life was like. I love living and I love the full bodied experience of living so much, which is why, I don't know, that feels to me like sort of part of an essential quality of what it means to be an artist. And yeah. It's a lot about sensuality as well. And so I think that in the pandemic, there was so much of that wasn't accessible that I just wanted to fight for because it's how I feel like myself.
Right.
And I know so many people feel that way as well.
That's the thing. It's definitely very relatable. And something that you mentioned in the Zane Lowe interview, you were talking about missing sort of like the physicality of music, and you were talking about like the music festivals, and for some reason, especially in Europe and England, which I do totally understand, the base of it and kind of like feeling that in your bones. And I guess I had never really thought too much about like the physicality of music, but I mean, there's a sound wave and there are physical things there. I'm just wondering if you can like expand on that. Is that something you've kind of always thought about with music, the physicality of it, or is that something you've grown more into maybe with this album?
You know, it's funny. Every time I get on stage, I think, all right, I'm just going to walk out there and I'll stand and deliver and sing. And I'm going to be relaxed and I'll just be with my band and be really present. And as soon as I take the stage, I can't stop moving. Like I just start whirling. And it is so involuntary. Like yeah. As soon as music hits my body, I move. And it has so much to do with adrenaline too. But music has always been so physical to me, and the way that interacts with your body. I mean, we're 70% water. So if you think about a wave going through water, like I always think about crowds, thinking about tides. Like you can really read a body of people from a stage and watch certain emotions ripple across people. And that physicality is really present in the record because it wasn't something that was possible in the pandemic. And I spent so much of the pandemic in Maine and it was so beautiful and I felt very fortunate and things were very quiet, but I missed there being something on the line. You know, I don't know that it's so much about danger, but like that feeling when you're slightly outside of your comfort zone or you're out too late, that feeling of really like being alive.
Do you feel like maybe you're talking about almost just adrenaline in any sort of form? Like I feel like during lockdowns, the only adrenaline I felt was like the panic of waking up every day and it's still really being happening, but there wasn't much more excitement. I mean, you go to the grocery store and that was kind of like the most exciting thing you could do.
Yeah, it definitely does have to do with adrenaline. And anytime I'm coming off of performance, there is a certain withdrawal. I mean, adrenaline is a really dangerous and intense drug. And being on tour does feel like having a very close access source to that drug. But I also think there's an element of just like self-presentation or performance and wonder how the night's going to go. Or I think it is as much adrenaline as it is spontaneity.
Yeah.
The idea that your night could unfold before you, like that was everything I wanted.
Yeah. Who knows what your night holds in Sicily tonight at like midnight or whatever time it is.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. It is 10. It's 11:10. And I think who knows?
Who knows where it'll go? So I think it's probably almost time to start bringing Adrian in. But just before we do, the last question I want to ask just about the album in particular and the topic is at hand is about, I guess, like the pleasure of making music and the pleasure of making this album. And I don't mean to project or put any words in your mouth or anything, but I think, you know, you had a really kind of quick come up and you were thrown into things, I think, very quickly. And that's sort of like the business, perhaps, side of things. I just wonder about that time that you spent in Maine and actually working on this album. And if you feel like you're at a place where you can really, you know, have pleasure making music again and exploring that maybe more than you ever had before.
Well, I think when I got back in Maine was I felt like I was able to make music like I did again when I was a kid, when it was just for fun and it wasn't for anything else. I think that allowed me to be more vulnerable than I had been before, but it also allowed me to really write about my life in real form. Like my sense of sexuality or sensuality within my art was something that I never had shared before because it felt too dangerous. It was really scary. And I found safety in finding really clean boundaries. But then I got to the pandemic and sort of felt like I had, in a way, betrayed myself because there was this whole part of myself that hadn't gotten to be part of the conversation or it hadn't been fully expressed. This record it's not like it was an element to bring out that sense of sensuality or talk about sex or pleasure in any specific way, but it was more of just an effort to do what I always do in art, which is to represent my life and my experience and know that it might not be for everyone, but I made a record that I really love and that I'm proud of. And I feel like more like myself in this record or on stage or in my day to day than I ever have.
And I think you hear that in the album. And I think so many people are like resonating with it and with the lyrics and, you know, with the sexuality and with everything, because you're human and everybody's human. And so that is something that actually we all share, like, except for like, you know, if someone's dog is listening to it. So it is something that we all have in common, and it makes sense. Just sometimes it gets too serious. And if you do what you love, sometimes if you make what you love your career, sometimes the pleasure in it can kind of get taken away. And I think sometimes artists need some time to kind of like get back to that, if that makes sense. V1&O is sponsored by Yuke's, the one-stop destination for art and fashion. I love Yuke's so much, and it's not just because they were our first ever sponsor for this podcast. They actually have an amazing collection online. Head to yukes.com and see for yourself. I mess up on this podcast all the time. Some of it you hear, the rest of it you don't. That's thanks to Citizens of Sound, a one-stop shop we use for all of our podcasting needs here at V1&O. Citizens will help you with conceptualization, branding, production, editing, and distribution. So whether you're an artist, an actor, or you just think you have a compelling story to tell, podcasting might be the right route for you, and Citizens of Sound are here to help. Head to their website, citizensofsound.com, for more information. So Adrian, my name is Matthias. I'm with V Magazine. It's super nice to meet you. Listened to your book, actually, because I really like listening. So I didn't read it, but listened and loved it so much. And I'm so happy that Maggie here wanted to talk to you more about it, because I think you write about such interesting things. I'm wondering if, to start, you can just tell us a little bit about yourself for the listeners. And then I'm going to dive in with a couple questions and let Maggie ask a couple questions as well.
Okay. It's so good to finally meet you, Maggie. And I'm really glad to be here. So my name is Adrian Marie Brown. I am the author of Pleasure Activism, The Politics of Feeling Good, and some other books about getting in a right relationship with change and science fiction. I'm a Virgo. I'm an auntie. And right now I am working on my first musical project. This is a very beautiful moment for me. Like, I'm going to talk to you, and then right after that, I'm going to go do a big presentation of the first 9 songs to this whole crew of people. So it's a really good day.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
That's so exciting.
Yeah.
I cannot wait to hear. I mean, you and I have like 6 other conversations to sidebar about, but that's so exciting.
We can do another podcast. if you guys want.
We'll do another one. We'll do a showing.
You are welcome here. Like, make this your home. Well, thank you for that, Adrian. I really appreciate it. And again, I appreciate you being here. And I guess I just want to start off by asking, when did you two first get in touch or even learn about each other's work? And maybe we can start with you, Maggie.
In so many of my communities, but especially at Divinity School. And I first read Emergent Strategies 2 years ago, and fell so in love with that text. And then we were speaking earlier, Adrian, before you joined us, but so much of this record had to do with sort of rectifying the relationship or putting back the pieces of myself that sort of I had put aside in order to protect myself in this massive transformation where my career had started. And what I said earlier in the podcast was that I felt like my sense of sensuality had gotten really removed from my relationship with my art. Never felt like I had almost betrayed a part of myself and wanted to make art that could incorporate that. So in doing that, I made this record and then entered Divinity School once I had already finished most of the record and was introduced to your book, which put to words so many of the things I had been thinking about and was so grateful for what is essentially like an essay. It's like a course. You know, there is homework in this book, which is just like my favorite thing in the whole world. So there's so much I was working through in my music that you were able to give language to. And I felt just so grateful for that. And then I reached out, I think, on Instagram.
Yeah.
Is that how that worked?
Yeah, that's what happened. You slid in the DMs. I mean, it was such a great surprise for me because I was listening to you back from when you first started coming out with music. I was like, I love this voice. I love the songs you write. And then it had been an uptick because I'd been doing this work that was like, I had done this interview where I had to take off all my clothes for the interview. And back in my body was like the song of like this, I made this whole like playlist and I was like, this is what I'm doing is I'm reclaiming my body. And similarly, like I was like, I'm a social justice leader. I can't be this like sex goddess person that I also am, but I also am that. And pleasure activism was born out of, I'm like, I'm reclaiming my sense of, I get to be a whole person. And actually my sensuality is where a lot of my power comes from. And your music was like just thrumming all those chords. And I think you posted first, you were like reading pleasure activism and all my people were like, girl, and I was just like, oh my God. And, you know, I remember watching that video of you and Pharrell and you just like bopping your little head. And I was just like, oh, you feel it. You know, what's coming is coming from inside out. And what we need right now is stuff that's coming from the inside up to the surface and out into the world. So, you know, so then we just started being in the Instagram DMs, like, you're great. You're great. You're great. Let's find each other. So here we are.
I'm so happy it led to this. And I'm sure it's going to lead to a lot of other things in the future. But it's a really beautiful merge that makes a lot of sense. For Adrian, I'm wondering just for any of our listeners who have not read Pleasure Activism, you know, my first question before I listened to it was, what is pleasure activism and why is it activism? So I'm wondering if you can kind of give like an elementary explanation of that.
I think of it as a pleasure revolution, truly. But there's this text from Audre Lorde called The Uses of the Erotic as Power. And I remember reading that text, and then you can actually listen to Audre Lorde reading the text, saying the text. But I remember listening to it, and every time it challenged everything in me because it was the idea that our erotic lives and what we feel are actually the source of our power. And there's all these systems that are keeping us from being able to feel that power. So pleasure activism is my dance with those ideas, is saying like, we actually deserve to feel good and to feel happy. And we deserve to know what it is to feel satisfied. And why do we move through our whole lives without knowing that? And what does it look like to reclaim that? And particularly for people who have some oppression structured into their lives, what does it mean to reclaim ourselves from the ideas of our oppressors in terms of who we are and what we deserve to experience in a lifetime? What does it mean to reclaim and just be like, oh, actually, no, I'm a whole human being outside of your constructs and outside of anything you think of me. And I'm going to have a really joyful life. And I think a lot of times politics is a deeply unsatisfying space. And we're just told that's the way it is. Like, you can have a dream of what needs to happen in the world, but what's going to result is a false solution that's never going to satisfy you. And one of the things I started saying was like, I don't want the fake orgasm of a climate policy. Like, I want the real thing, you know? And to me, it's like, how do we actually start to cultivate our sense of satisfaction such that when we are fighting for what we desire in the world, that through line comes. It's like, oh no, this isn't good enough. Our standard is here. I want the real thing. I want to actually be able to feel it. And I want something that's going to serve not just me, but my whole community. So it's not like I went to the spa, pleasure activism. It's like, I made it so that everyone in my community knows what it is to be well fed and well nourished and get massages and get care and have an education and have sovereignty over our bodies.
For me, and again, tell me if I'm wrong about anything, but I think one of the most exciting things about it is something that you can practice like really autonomously. And maybe that's sort of the whole point of it. I mean, voting is so important. And we just did an episode on gerrymandering and of course it's so important, but there's certain things that you can just control within your own sphere. And so much of what you wrote about, you know, somebody could instantly start practicing a couple of those things. So yeah, that was one of the most exciting parts for me, was just kind of how accessible I felt that it was. But Maggie, I wonder if there was anything that, like, I don't know, just parts of when you were reading Adrian's book that like really stuck out to you, that you were really excited about, that you wanted to sit and talk to friends about over drinks or what have you.
Yeah, with my alleyway into the book, rather with my work specifically, is the role of imagination in pleasure and how these radical acts of imagination can dream us a new world, that in our fundamental dissatisfaction with the life we live, there is another world that we imagine where we are satisfied, and that pathway is available to us at all times. That was sort of my space into the book, but I actually wanted to bring it back to Audre Lorde because I was revisiting the essay, The Erotic as Power, before this, and just thinking about what it would be to have this conversation. And I was reminded of her definition of the erotic. And she writes that it's a measure between the beginning of our sense of self and the chaos of our strongest feeling. as an expert, wanted to ask you about the chaos.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's abundant in our lives.
Yeah.
And at least in my life right now, I'm in this space of integration.
Yeah.
Where I've spent a year writing about artistic practice and spirituality and pleasure and imagination and all these things. And now I'm actually in the tricky part of having to go do it, which is so much harder than just writing about it.
That's right.
I was curious about how this is implemented in your life on a daily basis. And what is your pathway through the chaos to get to the erotic?
Yeah. I mean, I love this question. You know, the first part of it is I have accepted that I am someone who feels and that it's actually like really good information. It's good data. For the longest time, I was like, something's wrong with me because I'm feeling way too much. Why isn't everyone overwhelmed by all that's going on? And like, how do I give myself permission to pursue pleasure, to take new lovers, to have a good time, to enjoy life when all of this hardship is happening? And how do I do it? And so the first part is I've spent 10 years in study of somatics, of just like learning to feel again, like really being like every single day, there's a cartography inside me of emotion and I can like tune in and I can gather data from it. My feelings have led me to a life that brings me so much joy. Like I really live on that. Yes. And even when I receive hard news, which is also the chaos, it's like a 24-hour news cycle and a social media stream that's never ending. And there's always stuff in there that's like really hard to take in. But I always turn my attention to like, well, who's doing something about that? Can I uplift that? Like if this really moves my emotion, what is it moving me towards? Does it move me towards action? Does it move me into prayer? Does it move me into organizing my community in some way? Like what does it move me towards? I've learned that there are emotions that I'm like, I could let myself get overwhelmed by this, but if it doesn't actually lead me into an action, it's not a place I need to linger. And that has been really helpful for me that I'm like, there's so much grief and not all of it is personal, but there's a ton of grief right now for me. I feel a lot of climate despair and climate grief. And so I'm like, okay, how do I make sure that every piece of work I'm doing ties me deeper into the earth and helps guide other people deeper into a relationship with the earth, right? So I'm not just like despairing for no reason or falling into hopelessness. There's also something about the smallness, and I'm going to get very like, you know, pleasure, you know, when you think about the body, right? It's like you have this whole body and on me, it's just like on my, and then I have this clitoris, it's this tiny, 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 tiny little place. But if I actually attend to it, it can transform the conditions of the entire system. Right. So there's a way that I really try to attend to that. Also, I'm like, okay, there's all this chaos, but if I can bring my attention to the right precise place, I can actually transform the conditions of this whole system. And so there's like kind of an orgasmic organizing that I'm always up to where I'm like, what is the smallest place that I can attend to that'll have the biggest impact? You know, it's kind of atomic, right? And that has been really helping me, especially I'd say these last 5 to 7 years, where it's felt like, oh, the US is really the leadership of a species that is the most problematic source on earth, right? Like humans are the problem right now. And so I'm like, okay, if we're going to make ourselves compatible with earth, what are the interventions I can make? Where can I really focus in and make an intervention that helps the whole species? So big dreams, small focus, tiny focus, like deep focus. Yeah.
Find the clitoris.
Find the clitoris. Go for that. It really works.
Can I ask you, I'm wondering, what was the first moment that turned you on to this work?
How did it happen for me? Yeah. I mean, I think that I'd say like in my mid-teens, when I really started to understand, like, I don't really understand how to interact with other people around my body. But I really am starting to have a sense of my body as a place of pleasure. Like that happened very early for me that I was like, oh, the world has racism and fat phobia and all this stuff. But like just me in here, it's really good. And if I connect with other people from that place, something else becomes possible. And then I was organizing. I was a social justice leader. I was leading organizations and doing all this work. And I started to notice that we would be in these spaces where we're trying to create a whole new world for people and invite people to join us, like come to this new world. And our invitation was like, everything is horrific and falling apart and we've got to save it all. Come over here. And I was like, you know, I'm not like, if I'm like choosing between that and like chilling on my couch and relaxing and being ambivalent or whatever, like probably going to choose ambivalence. And I was like, how do we make the invitation more delicious? So in my organizing, I started to be like, well, how do we make the meeting feel good? How do we make it feel satisfying? How do we feed people? How do we play great music? How do we have great shows? How do we think of this as something that we want to bring people into, and we want them to feel like, oh, the future could feel like this? Yeah, mm-hmm. I want to come back. And so that kept hooking me back into like, what would it look like to have pleasure be at the center of how we think of organizing? And, you know, I remember there was this man, Keith Kyler, who started a project called Housing Works in New York. And he was like a pleasure being, a total pleasure being. And I was doing harm reduction work, and I was like around all these people who were like, yeah, pleasure is political, feeling good. And trying to find that balance of not numbing and escaping and endangering ourselves, but actually being able to be more present in our bodies. All of that really lit me up. And I'm constantly thinking about, you know, maybe it's a sexual Buddhism or something, but it's like, yeah, come in, like, be like, I'm being present, right? It's really a different meditation. It's like, I want to be, the best erotic experiences happen because you're fully in it. You're fully there, you know? And I think on earth, I think we had to learn how to be fully here on earth for humans to actually last here. Right now, there's so much dissociation and distraction.
Yeah.
And so people are like, not even, I'm like, do you understand that this is not a given? We don't get this forever. Like, so yeah, there's all of that. That's the stew for me.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
I got so obsessed this last year with radical joy and the radical joy protest movements.
Yes.
In the 60s and 70s.
Yes.
That led me sort of naming my tour, the Feral Joy Tour.
The Feral Joy Tour brought me so much joy. I loved it.
Man.
I loved it. And I also love what you're doing with this album, like the surrender. I just feel like there's such a sense of, when I think of you, when I think of this album, you're like on your knees, on the floor, like thrown all the way back. Just like, I'm giving myself totally. I'm inviting you to come totally be with me in it. And it's like, that's the kind of art we need right now, is art that's just like, come all the way, be very direct about wanting it, wanting you, wanting to live, wanting this, like, that's the right direction.
Thank you. I mean, I think I saw the other side is part of it, you know, and that's this idea of feral joy, is that like, the more I interacted with rage, the more my capacity for joy grew.
Yes.
I also saw a world in which my, within the systems of the music industry, or just the box me or my creativity was being put in, I saw a world where it wasn't very fun to make music.
Yeah.
And I shrunk away from it and thought about maybe doing something else. And I love music so much. And it is so joyful and sacred and contagious. And I'm such a fan and have so much reverence for it.
Yeah.
That so much of this record was also just deciding, like, fuck it, I'm in. I could either go away or double down. And I sort of classically chose doubling down.
You know, I think what you describe as like industry sucking the joy out of a thing happens everywhere, right? So like in the nonprofit work where I was, it was like the joy is being sucked out by the philanthropy. And then in the art world, it's like it's being sucked out by something else. Different places you might be, it's capitalism, you know, fundamentally, that's like sucking the joy out of existence. And so then when you say, I'm going to counter that, and the counter is not like going to attack something, it's like, I'm going to actually be more fully embodied. I'm going to be something that capitalism can't capture, cannot commodify, cannot stop. And I'm going to create something that becomes irresistible. You know, Tony K. Bambara said that, and it's in the book, is like, we have to make revolution irresistible, because it's only if it's irresistible that it can actually pierce through the comfortable fog of capitalism, right? And that's what I feel in this album and in the performances you've been giving. It's like a real sense of, you can't box me into anything. I'm not going to be the little girl you met years ago. Like, I'm going to continue to grow and continue to change and stay in touch with my wildness, which is also part of it. It's like, we're wild animals. We're nature beings. Like, there is a part of us that has to be wild, and our rage is good medicine for that. Our joy is good medicine for that.
It is the wildness too, in the way of, so much of it has to do with cultivating a relationship to the divine feminine.
Yes.
For me, and there's no reason specifically, it also doesn't need to be gendered, but the way that's the language and the way that it's shown up in my life, where I think that so much of the industry that I exist in inherently identifies as cis and male.
Yeah.
And so I show up, or in the beginning, I would show up trying to match that energy, or trying to swim in it because I wanted to be tough and hang. And so much of it, as you're speaking about existing within this capitalistic system or within these spaces to really find a joy, has to do with being in relationship to that feminine or to the mother that is earth or to the person or the part in me that is the poet, that is the sensual, that is the erotic, because that person is the version of me that experiences life with the greatest capacity and in doing so is able to make the best art.
Yeah, I've been thinking of that as like the divine interdependence or the divine connectedness, because it's like part of what it is it's like, this is the part of me that can feel, and I first tapped into this like on mushroom trips and stuff, but I was like, oh my God, it's all one totally connected thing. I first was like, oh, the women in my life know this because they're mothers. And so it's like, when you produce a life in your body and you see, it's like, oh, it's all connected. I get it. But for those of us who don't parent, or we come at it a different way, or we come at it a different body or whatever, it doesn't negate the fact that we actually are all connected. And when you realize that, and you realize you've been told to pursue individualism and disconnection and competition and being above others, and it's like, the only thing at the end of that pathway is a loneliness, because you have denied your own humanity, then you have to fall back to earth, literally fall back into the dirt, you know, get back to it. And, you know, some people, it's like a relationship awakens that sense of I can reconnect. Some of us, it's like, I'm a hermit. So I'm like, I'll go be by myself. But I'm like, oh, the ocean is making love to me. We're all connected. I'm a saltwater being. The moon is pulling me, you know, and it's just like, oh yeah, it's all one thing. And then why would I disconnect from that? And of course, then all the songs and poems and essays and everything flows, like the universe wants to speak through us all the time. You know, she's thinking, right?
It's not as a marketplace, but as an ecosystem.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so funny to speak about this on a podcast, only because I feel like so much of spirituality is the study of experience.
That's right.
Or experience that point people towards living or acting according to their highest potential.
That's right.
Or like capacity, potential being like a spiritual potential.
Yes.
But the thing that occurs to me is so much about this that we're talking about is feeling. And the best part about feeling is that there's no language to hold it.
Exactly. I'm laughing because the piece that I'm working on right now is called To Feel a Thing. And it's like all about just like, how do we learn to feel? My friend Angel Kyoto Williams is a Black Buddhist reverend. And she said to me years ago, she's like, you know, all this technology is advancing to increase our capacity to like be connected and know everything, but we're not developing the spiritual capacity to hold all of that additional connection knowledge. And so part of it is like trying to give people the very basic tools of like, yeah, how do you feel a feeling? And when you feel it, how do you express it to someone else with some responsibility and some sense of impact without denying yourself or denying your truth? And I'm really interested in the ecstatic, right? Because I think that in early spiritual pathways, so much of it was about how do we surrender to the ecstatic? How do we bring ourselves and open ourselves to the ecstatic experience? And then so much of organized religion has been trying to control the ecstatic and create like a, you can only reach the ecstatic through this man in this hat or whatever. And instead being like, no, what about I can feel the ecstatic with my loved ones. I can feel the ecstatic in bed. I can feel the ecstatic on a walk. I can feel the ecstatic because it is always there. And I keep trying to be like, how do we decouple it from an individualistic story? We all have access to this divine ecstatic potential. What do our lives look like if that's at the center?
This is where I come to music too. I mean, like just the sense of feeling. Like yes. I so deeply long for anything to be simple. And when I think about what it means to come together, I may not know anything about this group of people, but I know that everybody knows what it's like to feel sad. And that if I sing you a heartbreak song, you and I may have nothing in common, but yes. Our human experience will allow us to resonate on the same frequency that is just like, ouch, that hurt.
Exactly. Or like there's one song that you have, You've Got a Friend. I love it because it's so personal. It's like, this is about a specific friend that I have and specific things about this person. But then the feeling of like delight and claiming and celebration is like so universal. Everyone has their person. You have me for all of your whole life. I know everything about you, you know, and I'm like, I ride for you, you ride for me. I love that. There's something about the more specific you can share, the more specific the thing is that you share, it's the more universal it becomes. I've been enjoying that process. I have a song that I wrote like from a place of deep heartbreak called Numb. And it's just like, I want to be totally numb. And I was like, I'm never going to share this with anybody ever. This is so embarrassing to even feel. And then every single person I share with is like, that's what this time period makes me feel like, yeah. Right? This moment in history is like a numb feeling. And I see so many artists being like, no, we're going to make it a huge feeling, a time to feel everything, a renaissance. So I keep wanting to ask you like how it's been having you and Beyonce released an album on the same freaking day. And it feels like y'all are both tapping into this joy renaissance energy too. Do you feel like you're on that wave?
I honestly just feel so deeply honored to be anywhere near in the same conversation yeah. with Beyonce.
Yeah.
My release date was chosen 9 months ago.
Yes.
And when the two aligned, so many people be like, oh, dude, I'm so sorry. And I was like, are you kidding?
That's amazing.
I get a new Beyonce record on this day where I was just going to sort of like feel weird and walk around anyway. Now I get to dance.
Yeah.
And I like for the first and only ever time in my life, was suddenly immersed in Beyonce meme.
Oh, yes. Because all the memes, everyone was like, she's riding a horse and you're singing about horses. We're all doing it. I was just laughing so hard because yeah. I was like, there's also the Venn diagram of those of us who are like super fans of both of you who are just sort of like, this day is heaven for us.
That's so sweet. I saw a great meme. It was something about like, we go to the club for Renaissance and when we're like coming down off shrooms and the sun rises, surrender happens.
Exactly.
And like, it is nothing but an absolute gift to share a day with her.
Adrian, I'm so happy that you asked that question because that is a brilliant and such an important question.
No. I needed to just tell you before we go that the emergence strategies concept about critical connection over critical mass changed this album cycle. It was something that I sent to every single person on my team in September of 2021. And everybody put it on a post-it note and put it on the computer.
Wow.
And it has so deeply changed so much of this conversation. So for anyone listening, this idea of critical connection over critical mass, well, I can speak for music. It means more to me that my music mean a lot to a small group of people than a little bit to a large group of people. The way that I translate that in talking to my business partners is there is a number on Spotify next to my name. What that number can't tell you is the amount of people who had the first dance at their wedding be Love You for a long time.
Yeah.
That number can't hold the emotional quotient connection quality that shows up when I actually get the chance to speak to someone in my community or who has received a piece of work that I've offered. Thinking about that, you know, the second record is this like really dangerous, fraught, mostly because of the way in which so many people focus exclusively on linear growth and really slowing it down and thinking about the way that growth can be spiralic. Yeah. That it can be an S curve, that it can be a circle, that it can find its own pace and its own time. That is sort of the way that critical connection over critical mass has found its way into my life.
Well, I mean, I love that. And I especially love your word choice of spiralic. I'm going to sit with that. I'm like, oh, I'm adding that. Yeah, I love the description you gave because I think so often, especially because we're up against big things, big culture, big moments, that we think we have to start at the largest size to respond and that success is only in the very large. And there's always this part of me and this idea of critical connections, which is the quality of the connection matters so much more than the scale. And if the quality is good, you can reach an infinite scale and be infinitely resilient, right? But if the quality is not good, then it doesn't matter how big the numbers appear to be. They're fickle. You know, that connection can break very quickly. And I love the idea that, you know, with the music you're creating, with the books that I'm writing, with the work that we're putting out in the world, we want people to be connecting as deeply as possible to us and to each other and to themselves and to this place, this time.
That's it.
we can't fail if that connection happens. Even if the human experiment ultimately doesn't last forever, the time that we had, the deep connection we had, is not a failure. And that gives me a peace.
Well, and it's about reorienting what success looks like.
Exactly.
Really towards that critical connection. Or in your words, find the clit.
Find the clitoris.
You can stream Surrender wherever you're listening to this podcast. And don't forget to check out Maggie Rogers live in the coming months. As you heard, Adrienne Marie Brown is working on new music as well as new books. If you're interested in learning more about pleasure activism, I encourage you to buy her book on the subject.
Thanks for joining us on this season of You Wanna Know. Stay tuned and subscribe to know when we'll be releasing our next episode.
V1NO is produced by Ryan Killian Krause and myself. We are edited by Citizens of Sound. I'm Matthias. We'll see you next time.